Hey, welcome in. I'm Doug Gottlieb. You're listening to All Ball. Talking a lot of college basketball upcoming. Bobby Regan will join us from Barstool Sports and an incredible, incredible coach, Randy Bennett, head coach of St. Mary's. We're going to ask him, has he ever paid a player? They were on NCAA probation, or he actually was suspended for a couple of games as a head coach. We'll ask him, has he ever paid a player? I'll ask him. Plus, how they got into Australia and how he turned around a two-win program to a juggernaut in Moraga, California. By the way, make sure you listen to the Doug Gottlieb Show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific, on Fox Sports Radio, foxsportsradio.com, the iHeartRadio app. Give you some quick thoughts on the NBA as the NBA season has tipped off already. I'm like anybody else. We talked about LeBron James. You can listen to that podcast. It should be in your queue if you're already listening to the All Ball podcast. I watched last night, and this is being recorded on a Wednesday. We drop on a Thursday. So I watched the Sixers' first game. I'm not surprised that the Celtics were that much better than the Sixers. And the Celtics are going to get better because Gordon Hayward looked rusty and, frankly, Kyrie looked rusty. But I was interested to see the Markelle Fultz thing. If you know anything about my career, you're like, that guy couldn't shoot. If you watch me shoot a basketball, you're like, that doesn't make any sense. The mental side to shooting is like the mental side to pitching, the Rick Ankiel thing. And I'll tell you, I think the Sixers have handled this all wrong. I think he should have played in summer league so he had game action as he's working through whatever sort of therapy he needs. He didn't want to look at a jump shot. It still has a bit of a hitch, and it's really, really hard to fix on the fly. And unless it gets fixed, it's going to kill his career because he's just, his game is not built. Like, Rondo's never been able to shoot and has slowly gotten better, but Rondo knows how to play without a jump shot. There's an art to it. Even T.J. McConnell, who's their backup point guard. Like, T.J. almost never shoots an open, deep three. Instead, he gets to his mid-range, gets to his spots where he can make shots. But basically, he plays without looking. But he's played a substantial chunk of his career without looking to be a scorer. Markelle Fultz's entire game was built around being a scoring guard. And if you take away the jump shot, it makes you one-dimensional, and he's not really comfortable doing it. By my estimation, the best way to break that is I played for a guy named Maz Track, who's currently an assistant coach with in the NBA, I believe, with the Wizards. And Maz was my coach in Phoenix in the ABA, and he did what my dad did when he coached me some when we went on tour teams, which is if you're open, you turn down an open jump shot and you force something bad, you come out of the game. It's the opposite of how you handle guys that shoot too much, right? Where you take them out when they take a bad shot. When you don't take an open rhythm jump shot, out you come. Out you come. Because you have to eliminate the fear of missing or the fear of ramification for missing. And I felt like for me, that's the way to do it. But you got to do it in game action. All right, more to come on the NBA. But let's get you to the college game and to the FBI investigation and FBI court testimony that's come out recently. Let's talk about the trial, which has been kind of oft discussed on Twitter and several writers have written about it, as well as kind of whet your appetite, get ready for what's going to be another weird college basketball season. We'll discuss why it's weird and also why it's interesting. Bobby Regan joins us. He writes for Barstool. You follow him on Twitter, at Barstool Riggs. That's at Barstool Riggs, R-E-A-G-S. And Bobby, I saw you wrote a piece on this, I think earlier today, and at the day of this All Ball podcast, it's on a Wednesday. What's your reaction to the latest on this trial, which now all of a sudden names like Zion Williamson and schools like Kansas are kind of getting thrown into the fray?
Yeah, I think out of all the programs that have been implicated in this whole thing, Kansas looks the worst with the trial, right? I mean, it started with Gasanola saying, self and the staff didn't know. That was his first day on the stand, I believe. And then there's text messages that kind of contradict that. You have the rumor, I guess you want to call it a rumor. I don't know because we didn't hear the whole conversation because the judge didn't allow it into evidence that Towns said, self-assistant, said that they were willing to do whatever for Zion. Kansas just right now, I think out of everything, looks the worst, which I wouldn't have believed, I guess, heading into it with, you know, everything that happened at Louisville and the other schools listed there. But Kansas, man, I don't know. It just doesn't sound like it's the best thing going for him.
Right? All right, I want to circle back to Kansas in a second, but your piece also dealt with the fact that Mike Krzyzewski said we've never lost a recruit to somebody, you know, because somebody bought him, somebody's cheating, and he really is basically, he and Roy Williams are like, I had no idea this stuff was going on. I had no idea this. And then, you know, part of the Kansas thing is where Zion Williamson's name gets brought up and what he desired, and the obvious, well, look, if Kansas was willing to pay up and do whatever to get him and he ends up going to Duke, well, doesn't that make the assumption that Duke wanted to do whatever to get him?
Yeah, especially the fact that those stories kind of broke, what, 4 hours apart from each other or so, doesn't look the best. I just didn't like the way both Krzyzewski and Roy Williams, and I think you tweeted out this morning that, hey, you can say that we're clean and you didn't realize the, I guess, depth of what everything was going on is, but don't pretend like it's not happening. I think everybody, especially when you're Krzyzewski and Williams and you've been around for, what, a combined 70 years or so in college basketball? Yeah.
The idea that Duke has never lost a player because somebody's bought him, that's laughable. The idea that, like, look, you got Marvin Bagley on your team, and maybe you didn't know all the details of it, but everybody knows his dad was legally being paid by Nike. So they found kind of their own legal loophole, and not every one of your guys found a legal loophole. And even if you said, even if you came out and said, hey, look, we know this is going on, and our way of handling it is, look, we think the ultimate payment is you play for Duke and it pays you, you know, 6-7-fold after you get done playing. Like, even if you said that, but to act like you had no idea and this has no effect in your program, like, now it's hard to take anything you say seriously.
Yeah, it just came off disingenuous for both Krzyzewski and Roy. It just didn't sound like, they almost sounded entitled, like, oh, this would never happen here because we don't need it to. But it's like, well, you know, it's still going on. Like you said, at least say, like, hey, we feel we don't need to, you know, go to the extremes that other programs are because you have the alliance to Duke, you have the Duke background, it helps if you don't make it in the pros. Something like that would at least make it sound more believable or real. I wasn't impressed with both Krzyzewski and Roy's answers.
I'll say this, that there is some plausible deniability with Bill Self, because apparently one conversation with Gasanola is inaudible, and who knows if there's actual figures discussed, but there's nothing in there that I've seen that says anything about money. It's more about the old getting it done term, right? We all think we know what it means, but we don't know we know, and it's not what you know, it's what you can prove. But I am interested in like Self just inducted into the Basketball Hall of Fame. They've won, I believe, 70 million consecutive Big 12 titles. And he's a close friend of mine, and he's always, you know, told me, hey, you know, there are years in which you're down years, you try and win 25 games, and there's, you know, once every 3 or 4 years, you got a legit shot to win it. This feels like a year in which they have a legit shot to win it. What do you think happens at Kansas?
I mean, the first thing is they can't play Silvio D'Souza, right? Based on everything that's said, he just seems like the one that you can't play. If they were careful with Billy Preston last year, I don't know how they can play Silvio D'Souza this year, when we've already seen the NCAA strip Louisville of a title. You know, that could be the possible precedent set for a school like Kansas, who is a favorite to win the title this year. I think that's the first step, is you can't play Silvio D'Souza.
What about Self, and what about his staff?
I don't know. Like, I'm completely dumbfounded by this, because there isn't a precedent in terms of a guy like Self where, like you mentioned, there's plausible deniability. What if they can prove with Self? No, I think you have to let him coach this year. Wait, force the NCAA to make a ruling. I think that's the way I would go if I was in charge of Kansas's athletic department.
Oh, no question. You have a new athletic director, and he's more powerful than it. And this is one of those others will take the bullet for Bill Self. but it does expose some things. I guess the last question, and I want to get the season. Bobby Regan joining us from Barstool Sports. He covers college basketball, does an outstanding job. Follow him on Twitter. Read his work as well. Do you think the NCAA, like, I've had high-powered college coaches tell me, like, look, I think we were looking to see how much it would clean it up, but now you start mentioning names like Kansas and Duke and LSU, and there will be other big names. How much do they really want? Do they want to purge themselves of these big-name coaches? Will the NCAA actually do anything about so many of these kids, so many of these stories? How do you think it ultimately ends?
I think there's going to be a medium. Like you said, the NCAA, let's be honest, they're in the business model, right? Like they're around for a reason. They've been around for a reason. It's still a business to a degree, and you have to protect your assets. And your assets are, like you mentioned, Kansas, Duke, along with some other schools that haven't been implicated yet, but we don't know. Maybe we didn't think Duke was going to be implicated at the beginning of this, and look where they are now. So I think you see them punish the smaller schools, the ones that are obvious, and to the lesser and to the higher degree, you'll see sanctions against coaches, show clauses, and things of that effect. But I think they're going to be very cautious with how they attack the Kansas and Dukes of the world. I think they need concrete evidence to go after them and either vacate a season, vacate a player, sanction a coach, whatever it might be. I think it's going to fall somewhere in line with that, just because we don't know what the NCAA knows. We don't know what's going to be released to the NCAA. They still have to do their portion of the investigation, despite the new rule that they can use what's said in court and everything like that to hand down sanctions. They still need to find out the whole context of everything and what coaches knew what players accepted what. So I think it's going to be a long process, even after all the court system's done. And I think it's going to be somewhere in the medium of, we're not going to see a complete purge, but there are going to be teams and programs that we know in power conferences affected.
All right, let's get to this year. On paper, Kansas, Duke, Kentucky, Gonzaga look like they're heads and tails above others, right? Obviously, Arizona's in rebuild mode. I think UCLA somewhere between, they didn't get everybody that they wanted back, and they did lose Holiday, who's their best player from last year and did everything. Yep. But overall, talent-wise, Villanova's going to be very talented, but they're going to have a completely new starting lineup and try and carry over that culture that's allowed them to win two titles in 3 years. Xavier looks like a bit of a rebuild, even though their two of their best players are returning. Give me your sense of somebody else outside of that big four that you feel like we could legitimately see contend for a national title.
I think everyone is glossing over Virginia. They were, I think, the clear second-best team in the country last year. Mm-hmm. And they return. I kind of correlated to, this is my comparison, is they remind me of the way people thought about Villanova heading into the 15-16 year.
Because they kept losing in the second round for four straight years.
That you lose a key guard, Darren Hilliard for Villanova, Devin Hall for Virginia. That was kind of like, okay, well, this is why they were able to do this. But then, DeAndre Hunter is kind of that Josh Hart, the NBA player that people expect the breakout year. You have the returning guards with Guy and Jerome. I think people are just glossing over Virginia because the lasting image is them losing to UMBC. This is a team that lost one game in the ACC last year, and it was in overtime. I think they are absolutely in the same mold as that Villanova team that won the title, where they were forgotten about, kind of, on the back end of the top 10 in the preseason, but everyone kind of said, well, they're going to win the Big East, they'll win 30 games, they'll lose in the round of 32.
I think Virginia's
up there with the rest of them in terms of teams that you should be considering a national title favorite.
It's a great point. I actually had a long discussion with Tony Bennett. He told me he'd come on my pod here sometime before the season, in which he said, hey, for the first time ever, they knew they could be beaten by a team that went small, and then of course you lose Hunter, and that gets even more exposed when you got to play two bigs instead of playing. But he said, "Look, we're going to evaluate ways in which we can evolve, still be us, and evolve." I think that happened with Jay Wright as well. You know, they didn't play. They changed how they played in addition to the fact that they had veteran players and they had guys that the entire year their focus was we're not going out in the second round. And if you remember that year, they dominated, I think, Iowa in round two. They just blew their doors off.
Yep.
And the rest was and though they won a national championship on a buzzer shot, we also forget that they beat Oklahoma worse than anyone has ever been beaten in a Final Four. Like all of that energy kind of finally came to be in the NCAA tournament.
They beat a good Miami team pretty easily too in the Sweet 16.
Yeah. It's a great point. Okay, give me one player that you're like, I can't wait to tell people about who they don't know about yet.
It seems obvious, but it's the correct answer, Tremont Waters. Like, do enough people know him?
From LSU, who was originally going to Georgetown, who played high school basketball in Connecticut when I was up there? No, I don't think people know Trey Waters.
I would say I think he's a first-team All-American. I think he's that good. He's the lazy comparison is kind of – he can do what Trey Young did with, obviously, the less volume of shots. I think he's the one who, if you're looking for a power conference team that can surprise some people, I think it's him. I think I really like this LSU team. I think Tremont Waters, like I said, I think he is SEC Player of the Year and first team All American.
And then of course Will Wade's one of the guys that got on tape talking. So Will Wade remain as head coach. It is LSU, and people kind of chuckle like, really? This is like of all the times to get LSU, this is when you get LSU, not when they have Shaq and Chris Jackson, who became a Mahmoud Abdul-Rauf, and any of the other litany of players, or the John Brady era when they had Stromile Swift and others. But once you got a guy on tape, it's a fascinating thing. Bobby, great stuff. I'm a fan of your work. Can't wait to have you back on the pod, and thanks for joining us on the All Ball Podcast.
Appreciate it, Doug.
Let's go from the discussion about this scandal in college basketball and getting you ready for the season with a guy who he's been in this business as a player and a coach, holy crap, for almost 40 years? My God, I had no idea he was this old. He's always kind of looked old, but now he actually is old. He's the head coach of St. Mary's, the only place he's ever been head coach. And what's crazy about it is they won two games the year before he got there. His first year, they won 9. Since then, they had one 500 season, two 17-win seasons, and a 19-win season. Outside of that, it's been 25, 25, 28, 28, 25. All 20-plus win seasons. Matter of fact, most of them 27, 28-plus win seasons. He's 392-162 at Tiny St. Mary's in Moraga, California. He's Randy Bennett. He joins us here on the All Ball Podcast. I want to get to your current job and how you turned this thing into kind of like a juggernaut in Northern California. But let's start. You grew up, your dad, was he always a junior college coach?
No, he was, he worked his way up. He started out at JV high school and then went to high school, and then went from high school to junior college assistant for a few years, and then he became the head coach at Mesa Community College in Arizona for 25 years.
But you guys were always you always lived in Mesa kind of growing up, because you went to high school and a junior college in Mesa.
Right. Right. No, I was born and raised there. The rest of my family was born in Indiana, and my dad played out there. So anyhow, he moved out, and by the time anything I can remember, he was a high school varsity coach, and then he went to Mesa and did that for a long time. Then he actually retired, and then he came back and coached high school for fun. He was retired, and they ended up winning the state championship at a school called Gilbert, but he's been there the whole time. He's been in the Phoenix area since I was born. So
what was it like playing? What was it like playing for your dad in junior college?
You know, when you're going through it, you're just going through it. Now, when I look back at it, it was. I'm sure it was a little tricky for him. For me, my first year, I was like eighth or ninth man, so there wasn't a lot of. It was tough for me because I wasn't used to not playing. It was really good for me as a coach because now I I understand what guys that are eighth or ninth or tenth men are going through, and so it helped me. But my sophomore year, we were good. Like, our JC teams were really good. And my sophomore year I played, and there was probably more pressure on him then. I didn't really feel it, though. Like, I had good teammates. I didn't feel like there was any animosity towards me being in there. And, yeah, I think my dad went over, you know, made sure he was careful not to play me if I didn't deserve to. And so, anyhow, at least that's my opinion. I don't know what those other guys thought. But it was good. Overall, it was good. I'm glad I did.
When you coach your sons in AAU, what are you like? I mean, it's always got to be, because I've heard you coach them in AAU, and which is really, really cool, right? And it's got to be great for the other kids. Like, wow, Randy Bennett is coaching our team. How are you as a coach towards your kid?
I would say I am definitely, definitely hard. I'm harder on them than I am on the other kids, and so it's tricky. And it's hard. There were some interesting car rides home after games. Like, I want them to play right, play hard. Usually it would be an attitude type deal, or just how they reacted to something. But I think it was good for them, but I think it was hard for them too. So as a dad doing that, you learn that you're there. They can only see you as their dad. They can't separate it, dad and coach. And you kind of can as a dad, but they can't. So they get tired of hearing dad a little bit. And I've run across a lot of dads who have tried coaching their kids, and they get the same point. The kids kind of, they'll tune them out.
Yeah.
A little
No.
Bit.
Listen, I do twice a week. We have a big clinic that we do, and my son, he's one of the younger kids there, but he likes to be a demonstrator, and I had to like kick him out of practice the other day because he wasn't listening to me. He's just having fun, and you know, was kind of being a jerk. And why are you getting so mad at me? And I was like, because you got to be one and a half times everybody else, and I got to be on you more, because if you act this way, how do you think everybody else is going to act? So I'm fascinated by it. Randy Bennett joining me here in the All Ball Podcast. All right, so you go to UC San Diego and play. This is back, UCSD is D3 back then, right? This is before they moved up to D2. Who's your coach?
My coach was Tom Marshall, and we're actually in AI at the time, and then they went D3 later, and then they went D2, and now they're going D1 in another year. So it was a great experience for me. Great school academically, but some of my best friends and to this day are guys I played with there. So we had great experience. Wouldn't trade it for anything.
Now, he's a former player, wasn't he? He's like a, if I remember correctly, like was he a player in his own right? Is that the same Tom Marshall?
No, Tom wasn't. When I went there, the head coach was John Block, and I had to redshirt that year because I transferred in there. And he left that year, but John Block was a good NBA pro player, so he was around. But then Tom was his assistant, and I think he probably played a little high school, but that's about it.
What was he like as a coach?
He was just learning. He'd never been a head coach before, so he took over that job, and all that stuff as a coach for me now, and when I became a head coach, was helpful to me as far as, all right, this is, you learn from your experiences, right, where you played.
Right, that's why I asked. Because
college, so and that was one of those deals is this guy's first job, and he's trying to learn, and he inherited this team, and anyhow, so he was learning, and he was a great guy. We had great experiences. We could, you know, looking back on it, we probably could have done some things players leadership wise and done a better job.
Okay, so then you go and work for Hank Egan, And that when your first job was at USD under Hank Egan, wasn't it?
Yes.
So take me through how you went from a junior college player playing for your dad, then playing NAIA ball at UC San Diego, to getting your... How did you get that job?
Well, I still had a year of school left, and so...
How many years were you in school? Wait. You were in junior college for 2 years. You redshirted 1 year at UC San Diego. You played at least one other year. How many years did it take you to finish?
Like I said, I still had another year to finish after I was done playing. So... I went over to University of San Diego, which was, Hank had recruited me a little bit at Air Force, so I knew him, and went over there to, I volunteered, like a volunteer assistant back then for that year, and it was eye-opening for me. Hank was a great offensive coach, great coach, and so I spent a year working with him, and then I went to Idaho as a grad assistant with Tim Floyd that was his first head coaching job, and that was a great staff. I learned, you just learn so much early on in your career with Hank. I did, and then went with Tim, and our staff there was Kermit Davis, Larry Eustace, and Tim Floyd. But
wow.
Back then you don't know who they are. Like you're just all scrapping and trying to hustle to get as good as you can. And shoot, I mean, Kermit was 26. He didn't know yet. Larry was maybe 30. And Tim, he's 32. That was his first job. So we were all trying to figure it out, but I learned so much in those first 3 years between Hank and Tim and Larry and Kermit up there. So those were great years. But at that time, I didn't realize how valuable they were going to be to me down the road. And so I can't tell you how many times I go back to those early years when I'm trying to figure out things in basketball, especially when I got my first head coaching job at St. Mary's 18 years ago.
Okay, so there's a couple questions that come from it. One, how do you make ends meet? Like, how do you afford to be a volunteer assistant in San Diego? How do you afford to be a grad assistant at Idaho? Like, where were you living? How are you paying your bills? What was it like?
So that's the deal in this profession, which is kind of crazy in college coaching. You kind of have to work your way up, do a volunteer year, do a grad assistant year, whatever you have to do to get in. And it's crazy because you're talking about guys who can be pretty successful in a lot of other trades, and they're willing to go and make no money or even come out of pocket to get in this career with no guarantees that down the road it's going to make a payoff back. But anyhow, I was just living life, and I wanted to coach, and I love basketball. So when I was at San Diego, I was just paying for everything. I had to do it anyhow for school. So there was no real option. And so I wasn't making any money.
So where'd you live?
I had to finish school anyhow. And then when I went to Idaho, where it was basically a scholarship, so they paid for.
But did you live in the dorms?
Money,
did you get an apartment?
I didn't lose money.
Did you get
the
dorms?
I lived in an apartment on campus.
Okay.
In the dorm.
And was there ever a thought? I mean, I guess your dad was a coach. Because we had Aron Ganot on, of course, your former assistant, and he volunteered for you when he started. And he's straight out of Swarthmore, right? He can go make six figures on Wall Street in the financial district if he wants. I just wonder if there was ever any pressure to hey, maybe you should just go and make, not, especially you finish up at Idaho, you got a master's degree. Should you go and actually make some money instead of chasing this basketball dream?
You know, it was never even a thought to me. And I knew what I loved doing. And the next step when you're done playing for me was coaching. And that's what I wanted to do. So my dad knew enough to tell me, hey, if you want to coach Division I, then you need to get in Division I. Don't go high school or junior college and then try and get back in later. It's hard to do. So I didn't know anything. I was just, this was my next step as far as, all right, I'm done with college. What am I going to do? And I knew for a long time that I wanted to coach. And so that's what I did. And I was pretty naive to it. I hadn't been around Division One and in Arizona. I wasn't hip to how it all worked. And it probably wasn't until I was 30 where I figured out, all right, this is what you got to do if you're going to move up.
Randy Bennett joining us. Okay, so give me one thing from Hank Egan that you still do or use or implore upon your kids today.
There's a lot of them, but I would say footwork when you catch the ball. I thought he's a really good offensive coach, and some of the fundamentals, just as far as catch, turn and face, bringing up your right foot if you're a right-hander, stuff like that. People go back and forth on it to this day, but I think he had it right, and it's what we teach, and I think it really has a lot to do with how you shoot the ball, and we shoot the ball pretty well, and I think it goes back to that. But he was Hank's biggest deal to me, and if you ask me one guy I coached with in college that had the biggest effect on my coaching, it would be Hank for sure, because I ended up spending 7 years with him. But his integrity was second to none. Like, he thought guys should act right and high character, and even his coaching, he was tough. Like, he's tough on kids. He was demanding on his coaches, and I was lucky to work for him. I was really lucky to work for him early on in my career, and it helped me a lot as far as just he got it. He really got it on the integrity and high character and being true to yourself, like acting right. And
all right.
Those impressions stuck.
What about Tim Floyd? It was his first head coaching job. Of course, he went on to Louisiana Tech, and then obviously Iowa State. We played against them; they were great. And then he had a couple stops in the NBA as well as USC. One thing that you took from your time with Tim Floyd?
A couple things. I think anybody knows Tim, he really knew the profession. He'd been assistant for Don Haskins for maybe 11, 10 years, somewhere in there. And he was pretty much doing all the recruiting at UTEP at that time. And so he knew the profession inside and out. I thought he was really shrewd. To this day, if I have a question on something like that in the profession, every once in a while I'll shoot him a call, see what he thinks on that. Now he really understood that. So I thought he was good there, and then he was a relentless worker, and just he obviously was a good recruiter, but he was a good coach for that age at that time. He'd been around Haskins, so he knew what he was doing.
All right, then you worked for Lorenzo Romar at Pep and at St. Louis. One thing from Roe that you still use?
I would say just how good he is with people. If I picked one thing that I thought Lorenzo was, he's really a talented guy and a great human being as well. But I thought he was just really good with people, with the players, the coaches. He just made you feel good when you're around him. He's an attractor, but just really good with people.
So in 2001, St. Mary's, who they had been good, Ernie had him going, and they went to the NCAA tournament. He leaves, and Silvio Dominguez, they win two games. He ends up getting fired. How'd you get the St. Mary's job? How'd that come to be? You're at, St. Louis at the time, and you guys had St. Louis pretty well rolling. How'd you get the St. Mary's job?
It was Dave Bullwinkle.
Bullwinkle. I said Sylvie Dominguez. It was, yep. Dave Bullwinkle.
Yeah, 4 years after Ernie did, and they had some bad breaks, starting with Brad Millard.
Had the foot problem,
broke
right?
His foot five times. Yeah. Yep. So, anyhow, how did I get the job? I was lucky, and that's bottom line. It was really down. They weren't paying a lot. And I was whatever. Somehow,
did you interview in person? Yeah, I mean, what, like, how'd you go about? I think, like, we have, you know, like, look, there's lots of basketball coaches listening to this pod. They're like, how'd you get it? All right, so you're at St. Louis. What do you remember about how you're like, St. Mary's is coming open, Dave Bullwinkle loses his job, you knew the league because of your time at San Diego and at Pepperdine, right? You know the West Coast because that's where you grew up, and that's where you grew up in terms of recruiting. But how'd you go about, you know, getting in front of somebody, and where did you conduct your interview, and what was your pitch? How'd you do it?
So I was at a point in my career, and I was at St. Louis, and really was a West Coast guy. Lorenzo took the job at St. Louis. I was at Pepperdine. I'd kind of, you know, I was at San Diego, and they brought in a guy. They brought in Brad Holland, and then I was hoping, you know, I thought I had a chance to get that job. And then same thing happened at Pepperdine, and they brought in Van Bredikoff. And so that's what I was talking about earlier. Like, I didn't really figure out how it all worked till I was like 30, and I kind of got. Not that I deserved the jobs, and they picked very good candidates, but it kind of, reality hit me. All right, wait a minute. These jobs are hard to get. I got to figure out how you do this because I don't want to change professions, and I don't want to be assistant all my life. But I had gotten to a point and moved out to St. Louis with Lorenzo when he took that job. I didn't really want to go. I just had no connection with the Midwest. I was, like I said, born and raised in the West, had gone to college out there. All my contacts were out there. And so I was ready to go take a JC job. I was right at that point, and I thought I could get one in Arizona. And this St. Mary's job opened, and I'd been in the league a number of years, probably 14 years before that with San Diego and Pepperdine. Actually, it'd be 12 years. So I had experience there, and I knew the school, but I didn't really know the St. Mary's job very well. It came open. I threw my name in there. Rick Majerus called for me, helped me get in there as far as at least get, they knew who I was. And then I think because I was at St. Louis, we were in Conference USA at that time. I think the athletic director, Carl Clapp, at the time at St. Mary's, thought that was a pretty big deal. Conference USA, Cincinnati was number one in the country, I think, the year before with yep. Kenya Martin and all them. So it was perceived as, hey, this is a assistant from a bigger conference. And I met with them at the Final Four in Minneapolis, in the right by the swim pool, in an indoor swim pool, people running by in their swimsuits. I was like, this is kind of crazy. I didn't think this was what the interview was going to be like, but I guess it went well. And then they brought me out to campus, and I think I was the last guy they brought in. And I didn't think I was getting a job. At that time, I was like, well, whatever happens, happens. I think it helped me, actually, because I wasn't nervous at all for the interview. I didn't. If it didn't happen, I was probably making more money at St. Louis as assistant, and whatever. So I came in there, and I think the fact that I'd been at University of San Diego and Pepperdine and the league, and I knew the league, I think that probably helped me a little bit as far as on an interview, answering questions, what I thought as far as what should happen to a school like this. It was very much like the University of San Diego when I was there. And so I had familiarity with that. I felt like it was pretty much the same job. And so it went well. And then I was sitting down there at one of the Pumps tournaments like that next weekend, actually 2 days after I finished my interview. And they called me and said, hey, we take this job. There's some other things that happened in between there, but pretty much that was it. And I was like, guys, is this really happening? So I was lucky, and I tell people that all the time, that I had to get lucky. And I think most guys that get these jobs, they get a break. And fortunately, I got one, and the rest is history.
All right, so you get the job, and now you realize I'm going from St. Louis, where you guys are going to the NCAA tournament. I think you had Larry Hughes as well, to a two-win team in a league that at the time was dominated by Pepperdine and Gonzaga. What was the program like when you took it over?
There wasn't a lot of confidence in the players. That was the biggest thing that I noticed right away. I think that happens. They'd won two games the year before, and their confidence, they were beaten up just from losing. And I'd been around that a time or two when we took over programs, like when we took over. When I first went to San Diego, they were coming off a down year. When I first went to Pepperdine, they were coming off a down year. So that was the major issue. We actually had some players there. When I got there, the two leading scorers from that team said they were going to transfer. And I was like, I think we'll be all right with that. Either way, I just wanted guys who want to be with us at St. Mary's, and I gave everybody a fresh start. I didn't run anybody off, and I just told them, I said, I'm not even going to watch film from you from last year. We're just going to start over and see what we can do. And we did, and they were great. We had some guys that really bought in. To this day, when I, you know, a lot of good memories being at St. Mary's now, but to this day, that first year was really cool. Like, just to try, and we had to get them to believe. They had to believe in
themselves. How do you do that?
Themselves.
But how do you do that?
I think it starts with working. You just got to work. You got to know you paid the price. And if you work, you'll start seeing results. And then when you see results, I think it's a cycle. I think you go back and you work harder. And then you see some more results. So, and then eventually they start thinking, hey, I'm not bad. I can make these plays. We played in some games. Our first game when I was at St. Mary's, we played a good UC Irvine team. They'd won 25 games the year before. And we were like up six in the last 5 or 6 minutes, and we just it was crazy to me how we just had a meltdown, and it was a straight confidence issue. They had not been in that position in a long time. And I think they had 21 losses in a row extending from the year before. So they got nervous being in that spot. So we had a lot of issues like that, that just psychologically you have to
You got to teach them how to win. Like, teaching a team, first you got to teach them to believe in themselves, and you got to teach them all other stuff. And then, like, the final step is, like, teaching them how to win. One, you have to believe you're going to win, but then there's a physical, like, these are things that we have to do, and then you almost have to, like, do it, and then you kind of believe in it even more, right? It's kind of the same process by which you believe in them you have to do in terms of, as a team, executing and winning games. Fair?
Very fair. And all those little steps, you forget they exist if you haven't dealt with them. Like, I hadn't dealt with that for a while, and I didn't realize how fragile guys could be. So it was different. The things we had to work on then are totally different than the things we have to work on now. Now we have to work on, hey, you're going to have expectations all the time, and people are going to have your name circled before they play you each year. So it's totally different, but it was great. I mean, those kids they're good. They had to fight through some tough stuff, and then we started getting some talent then, but it had to get older and more confident and better leadership and all that stuff. If I was a better coach that first year, we probably could have won. We won 9. We probably could have won 13 or 14. And but as that happened, we were able to get better players and more of them. And
Daniel Kicker was the first. Was the first big Aussie, right?
Yes, he was the first. He was our first All League guy that we recruited.
Okay,
he was good.
So you how did you come? Do you remember how you got Daniel Kicker?
I totally remember how we got Daniel Kicker.
Okay, go.
We took my first year there. We took Adam Caporn in August, late August. He was like 4 days late for school. It was that late. And we had two scholarships at the time. And I hadn't even seen him play.
Cape Horn, you hadn't seen? You hadn't seen play?
I hadn't seen him. Saw him a little on video, but we just needed some guards. It was hard to get guys at that point. And this kid wanted to come over. He was looking at Division II school. And I basically, it was like first conversations. I said, hey, you don't know me. I don't know you. You don't know much about this place, but we could use you. I think we'll get good in time. Love to have you. You want to do this? And he said, sure. And that was that. And then he was on the, we had to hustle, get his visa, everything straight, get him in school, but he's a really good student. Anyhow, he came. He was great he's way better than I thought he'd be. And he told us about kicker. He said, I think I got a teammate that could maybe help us. That was kicker. And so that's how we found out about him. We recruited him. He liked Adam being at our school, helped. And then he liked St. Mary's, he liked our situation, knew he was going to play a lot right away, but he was really humble and he was okay with he didn't really like the recruitment. He didn't like being stroked. That wasn't what his deal was. So he I think the assistant from Oregon at the time told him, hey, this is the worst basketball decision ever. And he was probably, I mean, knowing what he knew, he's probably right. But it turned out to be a great decision for him because he ended up being an all-time leading scorer at St. Mary's. But it's just, it's funny how those things work out. And that was kicker. When I look back, kicker was a big piece in us turning this thing.
And then, of course, you had Patty Mills. I remember when I came and spoke at your kickoff banquet when Deli was a freshman. And you're like, hey, that's my next great player. And I was like, really? Like he looked like, he kind of looked like Teen Wolf. He had so much hair, right? Like he had just like leg hair, and he was kind of thick legged. And I was like, I don't know. And he kind of had a funky looking shot. And you're like, yeah, you just got to trust me. You just got to watch him play for a while. And I was like, I don't know. What's it like to coach all those? Because this is more outsider and any Aussie that I've played with or dealt with, they all seem like they just kind of got it figured out, right? Like they play super hard. They're like physical to the point of like, are they being dirty or are they just, they don't mind it being physical. They're like right on that edge, you know? And then after the game, it couldn't be better dudes. They all like to drink beer, it seems like, and have a good time. Is that, you've coached a lot of Australians. I know that I'm making assumptions about a bunch of kids I don't know about, but how accurate did I nail the scouting report?
Pretty accurate. I would say the one common denominator, most of them are tough. They're not all physically tough like that, but some of them are. They're just like everybody else. But the one common denominator is they are great teammates. Like that is part of their culture. That's part of Australia. They are not into the it's all about me deal, or they're not even comfortable with like, hey, you're the man. Like we told Deli, hey, you're the next great player. He would not be comfortable with that conversation. He would change that conversation in a second. And they're Patty too. And those guys, they are great ones. And but to a man, their team spirit, being about the team, enjoying being part of a team. Those things are. That's the one thing that every one of those Australian kids has in common. And we've had 18 of them, 19 now. They're all great guys. Like we have no issues with those guys, and they turn this thing into our program's obviously got a big they're a big part of it as far as just the culture of our program and even our school and our community. So it's been a cool story. Once again, I mean, it was kind of a fluke deal, and then good things happened. So we doubled down, went back down there and brought some more in. Once Patty came, it really, because he was kind of the poster child for the youth basketball over there at that time. He played in the Nike Hoop Summit, and so everybody knew he was good. When he decided to come here, which was crazy that worked out the way it did. He really got under recruited, but anyhow, when he came
didn't
here,
didn't you take him super early? Wasn't he? Didn't they play on a tour? I remember. Tell me if I'm wrong. I remember AIS, the Australian Institute of Sport. I remember them coming on a tour and playing, and you going and seeing him, and him committing to you early. Is that? Am I misremembering? Am I remembering a different player?
They did come on a tour, and they came up to our school, so we met him early. We had gone on a tour over there and had seen him, seen their young guys when we played on that tour. But he, funny story on him, when he came on his visit, he had two visits. He took two visits, and they're going to be Utah and St. Mary's. And so he had a buddy over there named Steve Way at Utah, and so so he had interest there. Obviously, he had some guys here that were from Australia. But when he arrived at Utah, when he got off the plane, their coach at that time had said, "Hey, we just took a commitment from another kid this weekend." I think Patty came on Monday, and they took the commitment. A kid came in and committed on Sunday. So anyhow, that's how good a guy Patty is. They said, "Hey, we can send you to St. Mary's right now, or you can just hang out with your buddy here for 2 days. It's up to you. But we don't have a scholarship for you." He was the best. He said, "Nah, I'll just hang out here for a couple of days and visit my boy." And so he did that, and he came in on our visit, and we were pretty much the only school that was that had visited them.
I got my own Utah stories that you might like. Okay, so I leave Notre Dame. And I went to Golden West College. Tom McCluskey, my old high school coach, my first year, was the coach at Golden West. And so I'm like practice All-American, and I helped him assist. I was like an assistant to him during the games, and it was an awesome experience. And you know, I worked out with Marv Murnovich. I got my AA degree. Anyway, so Rick Majerus starts recruiting me because Andre Miller was a Prop 48, and at the time, I think he was a junior, and so I was going to play with him for 1 year, and then I would have 2 years without Andre. And so Rick Majerus, first he comes to Golden West Gym, and I practice against the JC team, and then afterwards, like, he and Jeff Judkins, they like, you want to stay and shoot a little bit? I was like, yeah. So literally, and Donnie Daniels walks in, so there's three assistant coaches and me. And they locked the doors to the gym, and they worked me out for like an hour and a half, right? Because his whole thing was like, "I don't know if you can shoot, you know." And so he worked me out, and he's like, "Oh, you can play." And so he basically offered me a scholarship, and they were playing UC Irvine like the next day. So I go to watch. This is Keith Van Horn and Andre Miller, and they practice at UCI. And it was an unbelievable practice. And I had never, here's my indelible moment in watching them practice. Two things I remember about Majerus' practice. One was he would yell at him, he'd blast him, "Van Horn, what the fuck are you doing? Go two lines." And they would, whoever he would yell at would run over to the baseline. He's not looking. They touch the baseline. They'd sprint down and back with two lines. They'd sprint down and back and then hop back in the drill. Like, it wasn't like everybody lines up. He just like two lines, three lines, four lines, whatever. And they were like robots, and they were sprinting their ass off because it was like, damn, if he turns around and I'm not doing it, I'm going to run all day. The second thing was he had like five walk-ons, and I thought walk-ons couldn't travel, and I don't know how he did it, but he had five walk-ons that were the scout team. And the guys that were in the rotation would sit in chairs, and they had their notebooks opened up. They'd watch the scouting report, and the walk-ons or whatever, or the assistant coaches or whoever was doing it, would run through stuff. Then they'd come guard it. Then they'd go back and sit down. Like, it was like a work of art watching his practice. Then we went to Spoons, and Spoons is like a, before there's, I don't know if they still have Spoons, like Chili's.
And, yeah, they don't, but okay. I know what you're saying.
Okay, so we're sitting there eating. And he's like trying to be on a diet. and I got like a burger and fries. And meanwhile, we're talking basketball, and you know, like I'm sure you sat down with Rick Majerus. I mean, it's just the most incredible, insightful basketball conversation. Meanwhile, he's eating all of my fries while he's telling me he's on a diet and he's eating a salad, and he's asking me about my burger. That looks pretty good. So then he orders like the same burger and the same fries I have, wipes the whole thing out. So they come back to town to play Fullerton like 2 weeks later. He comes to my house for an in-home visit, and my mom makes this huge kind of spread. And he's like, listen, you know, tomorrow they're going to pass a rule where Prop 48s, can, if they graduate on time, can get that year back. So look, his vision was I would play, me and Andre would play together for a year, and then Andre would go to the pros. And in this particular case, he basically told me like the very next day, which it did happen, Prop 48s could get their year back. So I would have had to play 2 years with Andre and only had the team to myself for a year. And I wasn't really, I just didn't think that was a great situation for me. You know, like I'm not really a two guard anyway. Neither Andre or Normie could shoot. And that wasn't, anyway, he stayed and had a great dinner. We had a great visit, even though he knew like it wasn't really a scholarship offer because it wasn't something I was going to take. So that's my own kind of Utah thought I might go there. And all of a sudden, and it didn't happen.
That is such a Rick Majerus story.
Yeah, he had great. Crushed my mom's fried chicken. Just crushed it. Okay, so of the things
he can turn on the charm too.
Oh yeah. Oh no question. Although he's the one who
he
told my dad
light up his team, coach him hard, and then he could just turn on the charm. He's one of the best coaches I've ever known.
No question. And obviously, there's some other stories which are amazing, which we may not we might not tell. We might tell. It's a podcast. We can tell. But yeah, it was pretty interesting stuff. Okay, so you've only won three tournament games, and I say only. Remember, like it's not like St. Mary's, but you've had all these incredible dominant seasons. You're competing with Gonzaga, who's now reached a national championship game, and you know lost by a bucket. Obviously, the Villanova game is probably your signature upset win. How can you get like what's missing from allowing you guys to do what a Butler, a VCU, maybe more Butler and a Gonzaga and some of these other programs that have been kind of mid majors and they've been able to compete deeper into March than you've been able to compete?
I think we won four tournament games, if you're counting the state tournament one.
Oh, okay, so I think they took one off. I think they took one off. Did they take one off?
No. We wouldn't have one taken off. Not. So,
okay, my bad. So you won four tournament games.
No biggie. But the bottom line is, I think you have the hardest thing is to get in the tournament. If you get in the tournament, you can – I don't think it's – it's not easy, but it's harder to get in the tournament than it is to win a game. And the last two times we've been there, we won our first game, and then we lost to Arizona one time and lost to Memphis the next or the other time.
Well, part of it is you also get bad draws, too, because you're like where Gonzaga used to be, where you never get a good seed.
No, but, hey, unless you're a one or a two seed, you're gonna get a bad draw. There's no dogs in there. It's all pretty even, and that's why I say the hardest thing is getting in. If you can get in, you got a chance to win. You got a pretty good chance to win if you get in there and you play well. You have to play well, but it's so I think it's that. It's just you got to get, and once you win one, then it's gonna get tougher the next game. So there are I tell our guys, hey, get in the NCAA tournament. There's no bumps, so you're going to be playing against somebody good, and you're going to have to play an A or B game to advance, and that's where it's at. So I think last year we were good enough to win a game or two in the NCAA tournament, but you just have to play well, and I think we could probably I think being in it and winning games, it gives you – you got to do that to – having that kind of experience, you need that. It helps you in the next time you're in the tournament. So if you can get a string of back-to-back NCAA – like Delhi went 3 out of 4 years. If you can get something like that, it helps you because you NCAA tournament is a totally different deal. And you just got to be used to the whole format and all the interviews and all the hype that goes with it. And all that stuff helps if you have experience. So I think getting in is the key. And then after that, you have to be big enough. I don't think you can play small and have success in that. You have to have some dudes.
Yeah. I mean, you've had dudes. I mean, we haven't talked about Mickey McConnell. Omar, you made into a dude, right? Omar Sanhan. Obviously, you had Patty. We've talked about, you know, Kickert and Cape Horn and all those others. Like, you've had some really good players. Okay, what's the closest you've ever come to leaving?
Well, I haven't really come close to leaving, but when Utah opened last time, I think when Larry took it. Anyhow, yeah, I was intrigued on that one, and so that if I have to pick a closest, that would be the closest.
What keeps you there?
I'm happy.
But so many other guys would be like, but you could be like $2 or $3 million happy at somewhere else. How do you balance that? Like, look, you still make a healthy living, and you live in a great place, an expensive area. You get on a long time ago, but how do you balance out the idea that you could just kill it financially with happiness?
Yeah, you pick another spot. You're not gonna. I pretty much know all the pieces and people that are in the right places at St. Mary's, so I'm not ever worried about those types of things. And I think, you know, you go to another school and you take $2 or $3 million, you're gonna have to deal with that. And so there's no guarantee. I think there's no guarantee that it's going to be as good a deal as I have at St. Mary's. It's probably unlikely that it is. If you maybe really had a great relationship with an AD or something and had a lot of trust there, then maybe it could be. But as I've been here, the money thing at this point, it doesn't really matter that much to me. And would it be nice? But if I do things right, I should have enough money that I should be able to be good for my career. So it's not as big a deal in that way, and money-wise, it's more a big deal in that, hey, Ollie, we have a program here, and there's some more fun things that you're trying to do. You're trying to build your program to last for the long haul. You have your guys coming back now. They're maybe a guy on your coaching staff. They come back with their kids. You get to see that. You get to see that they're proud of this. This is their family. This was their coach. That stuff, it's hard to put a price on that. It's pretty cool, and everybody doesn't get to have that. You have to be at a program a long time to have that, and I actually really enjoy that. And it's not – when I took the job, it wasn't like I had some master plan, hey, I'll stay at St. Mary's. I was hoping we could win a couple games. So you just kind of – that's just kind of – as I've been here – longer, I've figured out, hey, there's some real rewards to staying in the same place year after year. It's a great place to live. I really believe in what the school's about. They've treated me really well. And I have all these players that are great guys and turn into great fathers, husbands, people, and the community. So it's I really enjoy that. I really enjoy that aspect of it.
Kyle's at San Francisco, and you know, now you're back competing with Roe at Pepperdine. You had Lamont before at USD. What's it like? What's it like to coach against a friend? Because one of the things about you is, if somebody sees you or hears you speak, you're like, "Well, that's a nice," but you are a fierce, ridiculous competitor. Kyle, the exact same way. Lamont, the same way. Like, you guys could go from being nice guys, a lot like the Australians, right? Like, you guys would go hang out, but when we're playing to win, now. What's it like to coach against guys who, I don't know if you're going to play UC Riverside, but like DP's the coach there now, right? What's it like to compete against somebody who's a close to your friend?
You know, if it were up to me, I wouldn't do it. Like, there's nothing I can do about Kyle being in the league, Lamont being in the league, he was in the league, and Lorenzo in the league. I don't like it at all. You're right. Like, you have to compete. So if you're going to have to play the game, then you turn all that off and you're going to compete. And but it affects – it's not as fun because you can't – like, I can't share stuff with Kyle that I used to ask him about his team. He'd ask about my team. You just don't do that anymore. And so it creates a – when you're in the same league and you're competing twice a year, it just puts a little – strain on the openness of that friendship. And so that's why, like, I won't play DP at UC Riverside, and won't play Ron at Hawaii and Rick Croy at Cal Baptist. If I can avoid it, we never played Lorenzo in Washington. So that's kind of my rule, is I don't want to play my guys that are my assistants or I worked with as Lorenzo's assistant. So it's not I don't like it, but when you get, you have to play.
Yeah, Rick's a really good coach. They're going to be good at Cal Baptist. I've zero doubts about that at all. You guys got dinged by the NCAA for a kid who never played for you, for an assistant that wasn't on the staff, and now you hear, well, I mean, like anybody else, you read about the college basketball scandal and text messages about major money either being offered and potentially being doled out. Like, what's the discussion inside your coach's office about what's going on in college hoop?
Well, there's two sides of this thing. The one is, hey, having gone through an NCAA situation like we did, and then I thought it was garbage, but having the stress that's on that, it's tough. It was tough. So I don't wish that on anybody. And there are, you know, you can be a pretty good guy and running a very clean program and sometimes get hit on this. So then the other part of it is, yeah, I don't think the FBI has this thing that wrong. Like, I think they're probably some of the stuff that's coming out. I think a lot of guys in college basketball would say, no, it doesn't shock me. Maybe the amount, but the fact that it's going on, it didn't. I don't think it's that prevalent, but I think most of us knew, hey, some of that stuff existed. And so that part of it, and when people act like it's not going on still, well, you just want it right. Like, you want it right. You don't want to feel like some people are getting an edge on you because they're doing it, you know, a way you're not supposed to be doing it. So it's I'm not holier than thou on it, and I don't think most guys are. Like, we understand, but there's certain things that they just don't taste right on this one. And so you don't wish it for them, but you're not. I think there's a lot of us in coaching right now that are like, are we going to deal with this, or is this just going to go away? And I don't think everybody wants it just to go away.
It's a hard question.
It straight. We want it fixed.
Okay. This is
not what it should be.
Have you guys ever paid a player?
No.
No. No, I mean, like,
I've never come close to paying
Has a kid ever asked for money?
No.
Never once?
No. No, there's been guys before that we think got hooked up, but I don't know if we could prove it or not. But
got hooked up from other players.
You don't want to say that because it's kind of a cop-out excuse deal. So you can't just say, oh, geez, they're getting them because they cheated. A lot of times they're getting them, most times, they're getting them because they had a better pitch. They had a better, their situation was better. They outworked you. So, anyhow, I never go there on that, but yeah.
To me, it's a very simple, like, have you ever paid a kid? Have you ever changed his grades? Right? You know, yep. As long as you haven't done those two things, I don't even like the idea that you have these recruiting windows opening and closing. Like, guys, a recruiter, let him go recruit. Like, I know it's kind of ridiculous. My dad back in the day, who would be gone for months on end, but I think now you can wear kids out to where to actually turn them off if you recruit them too much. If you're texting them too much, if you're calling them too much, you're hanging around too much, like it gets a little bit creepy to some kids. But I kind of think those are the two questions, right? And I kind of think we go from there. But the idea that this does go on, what would you say the percentage of times this goes on?
I don't know. I'm probably the wrong guy to ask. I don't know. I think it's there's probably some outliers on this, but I think the ones it goes on with are the ones that are going to be NBA guys that are going to be lottery picks. I think that's these guys are worth a lot of money to some people. It could be agents. They're worth a lot of money to an agent if they sign them. Like, we're talking about guys nowadays, if they're the future LeBron James or Kevin Durant, they're worth $500 million. So as an agent, you're gonna do what you have to do, I guess, to sign one of those guys. You're gonna make a lot of money off them, and so there's other people that can make money along the way as well. And $10,000 to a guy, $10,000 to get a guy that's gonna make $500 million is nothing.
Yep.
And so I get that. I totally understand that. And some of it is, if you're an agent, I'm not sure why that's not smart. I don't know the legalities of it, but you would do what you have to do to get in tight with a runner or a relative or whatever that can help influence that guy to come your way when he goes pro. And yes, they're probably working that angle before he's a pro. So, I get it. These guys are worth a lot of money now, and that has changed. It's changed recently. I'd say in the last 10 or 15 years, the numbers have just shot up. So they got to. I think what we all want is we want this thing fixed, and they're going to have. There's some things in the system that they need to. I don't have the answer. Is my answer, but I think we all would like it to get fixed because it's not really.
I think
we're dealing with a very elite group of kids that people know are going to be worth a lot of money, so they're going to do about whatever they have to do. And I'm not necessarily talking about coaches. I'm talking about the other people in between, right, whether it be the shoe companies or agents or whoever.
Well, also, I don't think you, like, it's one of those, it's like lawyers, right? If somebody walks in and says, what do you do for a living? I'm a lawyer. Like, because there are unsavory lawyers, be like, oh, lawyer, like, wait a second, I'm a, I'm a public defender, or yeah. There's plenty of lawyers who do a very good job for their clients, by their clients, it's the same thing with the basketball. It's like, if you said you're a college basketball coach, I think there are some that would perceive you as, oh, those guys are just basically used car salesmen because of perception more than reality, right? The reality is your kids come, they have a good time, they usually play an NCAA tournament or play in an NIT, they play in these epic battles with BYU and Gonzaga and on national television, they get a degree, they make friends for life, and many of them go and play a little bit professionally and then go on their merry way, or maybe they come back and help you coach. Like, that's the reality of it, but the perception of it is a basketball coach is a bunch of used car salesmen, right? But that's not, and that's the part that I think coaches want to fix most, because they know that 95% of guys are better off because they got a chance to play ball in college. They met their wife there. They met their best friends there. And they gave themselves a chance to have a life after college because of it.
Even higher.
Yeah.
But yes, I agree. I'd say it's probably above 95%. But
okay. Couple other things. Give me one coach who you really like or really respect, watch his tapes or whatever, learn from, and they have no idea. Like, it's not somebody you've reached out. You just like, I have a certain coaching crush on this guy.
One program I have a lot of respect for is, but he I think he kind of knows, is Sean Miller. I think they do a great job coaching. And I think I'm always, if I can get a chance to watch Wichita State, I'll watch them. They play so hard and defend so hard. So there's two. I think Tony Bennett in Virginia, a lot of respect there for way he's way he coaches and how good they are, again, defensively. And they're good. I mean, they're just so consistent. But those would be three that, like, I told my assistants, hey, get some film on these guys. I want to watch a little bit of them in the off season.
Your team is young this year. This is a new group. There's a lot of youth there, whereas in the past you guys have been able to, you know, to draw on so much experience. How hard is that, especially in a league where you have a team like Gonzaga that most people think have a chance to win it all?
Yeah, it's challenging. It's a fun challenge, but it'll be challenging, especially I think our non-conference schedule's pretty tough this year, and so with a young team early on, I think we'll get it together, but we'll probably have some growing pains along the way somewhere. But I like our personnel. I think we have good players. I just think we have so many guys. We have eight out of our 13 scholarship guys are guys that didn't play last year for us. So there's so many new pieces. You guys have to play new roles, and I don't really know a way to rush that. It just takes you have to have enough practices, and you have to have enough games under your belt where they can get confident playing their new roles and grow into them. But like Jordan Ford has to turn into our best scorer, best player, and last year he's probably third or fourth. So he's got to make a big jump, but. Hey, we have to do that with about nine guys.
How do you do that? How do you make Jordan, like, do you? Because one of the things that Eddie Sutton would do is we'd play the UT San Antonios of the world, and we'd get to the second half, we'd be up 25, and we were still running plays for Adrian Peterson or Desmond Mason because he wanted it known throughout our team. When we need a bucket, these are the two guys, and those guys to understand he had the utmost confidence in them. How do you do you allow it to happen organically? Like, how do you do that?
No, I don't think I guess it happens a little bit organically, but you kind of have to set it up where it can happen that way. I think one of the first things you have to do is you got to figure out who your eight or nine are. And if you're, at least for me, if you're jumping around all over on that, then you're not going to be able to get a group of eight or nine to play together to understand their roles. And then once you have that, then you can start working on the guys after that. But so for me right now, that's our biggest challenge. Whereas a team like we had last year, I didn't have to worry about that at all. We had these guys. This was pretty much third year in a row we had them, and they're playing the same roles. And so I knew we'd be good. And this year it's different. And I think so. We don't have a lot of teams on our non-conference schedule where you have a lot of leeway there on whether to win or not. So that's the. You better get good first, and then try developing those other guys.
You got a couple of transfers. Malik Fitz, obviously from San Francisco, but Aaron Menzies. He's 7'3". Is he still 260? Did you lean him up? Like, I've never seen him play, but it feels like he's a block out the sun sort of big guy. And you've had some big guys, but a lot of your big guys have been really skilled facing up. What's Menzies like?
Menzies is. He's a good athlete. At one point he was a 300-pound guy, but he's 265 now, and he's in good shape. He's a good athlete. So he is not a face up guy. He's straight low post guy, and he's pretty good. He was 11-8 last year at Seattle U. Wish we had more time with him, but he's doing well. So we have to. He'll be more like an Omar type guy.
Right. Started out heavy, and now all of a sudden Omar's like super thin. I don't know, maybe.
Right, we thinned him up. He got down to 250, 255 when he was senior.
Omar
started out 300.
Is Omar your greatest, like, if you're like, hey, this is our program? Is it Omar? Is it, give me one, who's the guy who, obviously you have a couple guys playing in the NBA, but is your signature in terms of player development, personal development sort of guy from what you brought into campus to what you end up producing?
There's a few of them, but and Omar would be one of those. Like, there's four or five of them that jump out to me where they weren't great players when we took them, and they just kept developing, kept working. He's one. Lawndale is way up there. He and Omar are like, those are the two bigs that really came a long ways. And like, Lawndale didn't, he played 5 minutes a game for us as a freshman. Maybe that was me. Maybe that was the problem. But anyhow, he just kept getting better. Dellavedova is, he's 100% one of those guys. He just kept getting better. And McConnell was too. Those are four. There are others, but those are four that ended up being really good players, like player of the year type players. Patty, we only had 2 years, and one of the years he broke his hand for half the season. So anyhow, those are the guys that we talk recruiting to new recruits, and we talk about player development. Those are the guys. A slide comes up on the on the projector of hey, this is what these guys did as freshman, sophomore, junior, senior, and they can see the transformation.
That's pretty amazing. And Mickey is a guy, you talk about being lucky. Mickey's a guy. New Mexico makes a coaching change, so he decommits. You end up getting him, and look what incredible career he had and has had, you know, since. It's some of it's luck, some of it's skill, relationships, and I think the respect that you guys have garnered to where now all of a sudden St. Mary's is a household name. Hey, man, I know this has been probably longer than you thought you would have to be on the phone to do the pod. But I appreciate it.
I could rap ball all day with you, Doug.
We'll do it again. We'll
do
it. And at some point, what we'll do is after your season's over, then I'll have you. We'll do some what you see in terms of watching NBA, because I think so oftentimes, just, you know, basketball is basketball. And I love hearing basketball coaches talk about what they're seeing with the NBA, because I know you watch the playoffs, especially after your season's done. Thanks for joining us. We'll talk to you soon.
Doug, thanks for having me. Take care.
My thanks to Bobby Regan and Randy Bennett. What incredible insight in building a college basketball program and getting ready for the college basketball season. I'll leave you with this from the NBA as we get ready for the season. I would encourage all brothers, sisters, mothers, cousins, uncles, friends, don't tweet, don't message on IG, don't post things about somebody else's life, because it becomes controversial, and though it comes back to you, it's like Kevin Durant's brother put on his Instagram page, 81 more to go until we out of here. And maybe that's the case. Maybe KD does want to get out of there. Maybe he feels like no matter what I do, it's always Steph's team. Maybe he wants to go to New York and be the guy who can save the New York Knicks. Knicks will have cap space for him. My guess is Porzingis barely plays, if at all, this year. And they try and keep loading up. As I love Kevin Knox, think he's terrific, but I don't see how it helps it. You know, this is the everybody wants a reality show. Everybody wants their name in the paper. And now we're talking about Kevin Durant's brother, who is merely a distraction. Even if he has the story right, it's not your story to tell. And that's the mistake in the IG message. Look, we'll break down some of the rookies, the Kevin Knoxes, the Trey Youngs of the world. I would expect Luka Doncic to have an incredible season with the Dallas Mavericks, because he's been playing against a higher level of competition, and he's older, he's bigger, and no, he's not as athletic as some of the other guys, but he's very refined, and I think he's playing with a pretty good team. I don't know statistically how to look, but remember, stats don't matter if they're empty stats and you're playing on a losing team like a Trae Young's going to play on. But I do think those are two of the leaders coming in terms of trying to win Rookie of the Year. And we'll break down their opening games. We'll give you a sense of what we think. I've told people that I think Giannis and KD are the two guys that are most likely to compete for an MVP. KD has a lot to try and prove, and so does Giannis. Those are the two guys I would keep an eye on. I think Portland's the team that'll come back down to earth, because they played way above their level. And I'm not sure the Golden State Warriors got better. I think they got different because they're not going to have their full allotment of players until DeMarcus Cousins is healthy. I don't love their bench as is, even though it'll push one of their starters to the bench. And if he's a starter, is he okay if they play small at the end of games? If they play with him, they have to play big defensively, which is not how they usually play. Make sure you listen to my show daily, 3 to 6 Eastern Time, 12 to 3 Pacific, wherever you listen to Fox Sports Radio. I'm Doug Gottlieb, and this has been All Ball.